In today's episode, I'm in conversation with clinical psychologist and self-directed education advocate, Dr. Naomi Fisher, where we're talking all about the current state of our education systems and the tools that are used to manage children as opposed to what children actually need to learn. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we're recording today, the Kabi Kabi and Gubbi Gubbi people. I would like to recognise the continued connection to the land and waters of this beautiful place we call home. I also recognise Aboriginal people as the original custodians of this land and acknowledge that they have never ceded sovereignty. I'd like to pay my respects to all Gubbi Gubbi elders, ancestors and emerging elders and any First Nations people listening today.
Welcome to Raising Wildlings, a podcast about parenting, alternative education, and stepping into the wilderness, however that looks, with your family.
Each week, we'll be interviewing experts that truly inspire us to answer your parenting and education questions. We'll also be sharing stories from some incredible families that took the leap and are taking the road less travelled.
We're your hosts, Vicky and Nikki from Wildlings Forest School. Pop in your headphones, settle in, and join us on this next adventure.
Hello and welcome to the Raising Wildlings podcast. You've got me on the potty today, Vicky Oliver, and I'm really excited to have our special guest, Dr. Naomi Fisher, joining me on the podcast today. I've just finished rereading her first book called Changing Our Minds, and it combines her in-depth knowledge in cognitive psychology, which I love, with her hands-on experience in raising two children through the lens of self-directed education. Now, you might remember recently in 2023, I had Peter Gray on the podcast, and when I was chatting to him outside of our interview, I asked him who he thought would be a great guest on the podcast, and he actually recommended Naomi. So I knew that this episode was going to be a really important conversation. Now, Dr. Naomi Fisher is a clinical psychologist who specializes in autism, trauma, and alternative ways to learn. She is the author of two books, Changing Our Minds, which is the one that I've just reread, and also her second book is called A Different Way to Learn. They're both about self-directed education, and she is the mother of two children. She runs webinars and courses helping parents, and all of her Instagram and Substack are valuable resources that I highly recommend. So I hope you enjoy our interview. Naomi, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I'm really excited to hear all about your story and all of your thoughts. So let's start right at the beginning. Tell me a little bit about how you even fell into psychology, and then I'd love for you to tell me your journey to deciding to home educate your children.
Okay. So my journey, there are so many different ways of telling my story, but I think one really important aspect of my story is that I moved around a lot as a child and I went to 11 different schools.
Wow.
So I got a perspective on schools, which I think is quite unusual, from the inside. Mm. And a kind of, I think, a skepticism, even as a teenager. I remember as like 13 or 14, hearing the things that schools said, you know, this is the way it must be, and knowing that they hadn't said that in my previous school. Oh, wow. And there was this kind of, hang on a minute, you're saying this is the way it has to be. I often talk about uniform in particular, because I lived overseas for a while, was at schools with no uniform, came back to the UK, uniform all the way, very strict about uniform, to the point that you could be sent home from school if your uniform was wrong. Mm. You know, and I was like, hang on a minute, the last school I could wear whatever I wanted, no one ever made a fuss about it. Now you're literally measuring my skirt to make sure it's the right height and saying I've got to have, you know, black socks, not white socks.
It's hard enough to just police that. Like, lots of kids don't like that and have had no experience of what it could be like outside of their own school, let alone you seeing it from one extreme to the other.
Yeah, I think it's like a process of training, isn't it? I think of the whole school process as when we put children in when they're really small, you know, we 4 or 5 year olds, we tell them this is the way it is. It has to be like this. And because they're so young, a lot of them just kind of incorporate that. This is the way it is. It has to be like this. And I think because I was moving around so much, that kind of got broken every couple of years. You know, it was like, oh, actually, this isn't the way it has to be. Oh, actually, it doesn't have to be. And I think that was a really
frustrating.
Yeah, but I think it saved me, actually. I think if I'd been at one school all the way through, I mean, I had lots of difficulties at school. Let's not pretend that I didn't. But I don't think I would have made it through as intact as I did if I had been in one consistent environment. I think it was the fact that there was continuous novelty that kind of kept me okay with it, most of it. Wow. Not with all of it. So talking about my story into psychology is kind of interesting too, because although I had this very unconventional path through school, I did well at school. I was a high achiever. I think, like lots of people, I made my choices based on achievement rather than necessarily what I wanted to do, what I was interested in. Mm-hmm. So I was very capable in maths in particular. And if you're a girl and you're good at maths, I found that everybody's like, hooray, a girl in the maths classes. And it was literally me. I did these advanced maths classes. It would literally be me and eight boys. And that was, you know, we would be a little elite extra maths group, but it would be just, I was the only girl.
Yeah.
So I got quite a lot of reinforcement about that. You know, you should do these things because you are the kind of pioneer, you're the person doing it. So I did physics, maths, and chemistry when I did my, I don't know what you have in Australia, but at sixth form level, I did an international baccalaureate and I did physics, chemistry, and maths.
Yeah.
Even though I did really love maths and I still really enjoy maths, but physics and chemistry were definitely not my passion. You know, it was like a slog. Me. It was a hard slog.
Yeah.
And really looking back, I did do English actually alongside it, but I should have chosen humanities or subjects that I really got was, but I didn't. I wasn't making choices because I wasn't really thinking about me and my decisions. I was thinking, what will get me on? What will I do well at? What will be okay? You know, what will be a career choice?
This is the pathway that everyone tells me I need to take because I've got the ability.
Exactly. I've got the ability to do it. And it was very much like that. The schools I was at, it was like, you know, if there was a kind of attitude, and I remember picking up on it, like, you know, anybody, it sounds so awful now, anybody can do things like English, history, psychology. In fact, they're like soft subjects, you know, hard subjects, which of course are associated with being male in many cases. I think that's not an accident either. Hard subjects like physics and maths and chemistry, you know, that's what you should be doing if you can do it. So I did that. And then I went to university to study medicine because I was kind of on that path. And I found medicine very, very hard work. It didn't come naturally to me at all. I found human biology really hard to get my head around, possibly because I hadn't studied biology at school. I'd just done the chemistry and the physics. And then I was really lucky to be at a university where we did all the medical stuff that we needed to do in the first 2 years. Then we had 1 year where you could choose whatever you wanted to do before you went on to clinical school. So there's like a division between the university academic bit of medicine, 1 year of something else, and then off you went to clinical school where you would be in a hospital learning how to actually be a doctor.
Yep.
That year was the first year, I think, in my entire education, bearing in mind this is the third year of university, that I could choose something with no consequences. So it was the first time I could just choose what I might be interested in. It didn't matter. I had a friend who did Chinese. You could really do anything in that year. It was amazing. Yep. It was amazing. You could just go along and join the cohort and do it.
This is actually blowing my mind. I'm just actually thinking, I don't think I've had a moment ever in any of
my that's been the case
where that was an option.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was really lucky. And I think it's unusual. Like at most other places, most other universities, if they give you a year like that, you have to do something kind of related to medicine. Mm. So, you know, you have to go and do extra physiology or extra biochemistry or something like that. But they were really like us. No, you've passed the exams you need, partly because they worked so hard in those first 2 years. You've passed all the exams you need. You've got this year to do something that you're interested in. And I did psychology. And it was just like a revelation. It was like, my goodness, learning can be so much more interesting than what I've been doing all these years. And I remember it just being like a kind of almost like a fire being lit. Like I couldn't stop thinking about it and making connections. And I was reading all the stuff just for my own pleasure. You know, I just really couldn't get enough of it. And I only had this 1 year and then off I go to be a doctor. So I decided that I wasn't going to go off and be a doctor, that I was going to drop out of medicine and take a different path. And I went and did a PhD in psychology. So that's an academic doctorate, three years of learning how to do research. Then I went on and did another doctorate in clinical psychology, which is applied psychology. So that's how to use psychology in mental health.
Do you know what I love about that is that you know, when people find the path, even though they've been told to be on a specific path to achieve some sort of success.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, when I hear you talk about it so passionately, like when you find the thing that lights you up.
Yeah.
And it is exactly that. You couldn't stop your learning. You couldn't, you just wanted to consume it. And I often think about that conversation, and this, I wasn't going to take it to homeschooling yet, our conversation, but often about, well, do homeschoolers, will they get into university? And, you know, having so many conversations with people who work at university, and they say, no, we love homeschoolers, or we love it when people are in our course and they want to be there, and they're the ones asking the curious questions, and they're learning.
That's what it's all about. Yeah.
And, you know, when I think about every single person who did my course going through university, when I did my education graduate diploma, there were like, they so rare.
That wasn't my way. People weren't there. I know.
No.
I agree. That's what I think too. There were people like that. And, you know, I was at a really elite university, so you'd have to work really, really hard to get there. Mm. You couldn't get there by accident.
Yeah.
But even so, and I mean, I don't think anybody explicitly pressured me to go down the path I went down.
No.
It was just kind of in the atmosphere, but also I think what happened to me now, thinking back as a psychologist, is that, and I think this happens to children in the school system, unfortunately, is that from very, very early on, we tell children in the school system what you really want to do and what you're interested in is less important than what we as your teachers think you should be doing and want you to do. And we're going to take a lot of your time, you know, really a lot of your time and energy, and we're going to insist that you do the things we think are most important. And the stuff that you think is most important, that kind of gets pushed to the margins. And I think we do that particularly in childhood, because the interests and passions of childhood are things that generally adults dismiss as trivial. You know, young kids, like I'm talking sort of up to 12, they're really interested in Pokemon, or they're really interested in Minecraft, or they're really interested in, you know, dinosaurs,
yeah,
or all sorts of things, which adults are like, oh, you know, you'd be much better off doing phonics or in maths, something productive.
That's right.
So we set up that thing right from the start where we say to kids, don't listen to your own kind of internal drive of what you really love. And I even think with myself, I was a passionate reader from a really early stage, which gets you lots of approval in the school system. But I was reading when I went to school, and I was always with a book, always with a book. And even that, one of my memories from at primary school was them saying that I should be encouraged to read nonfiction because I was reading fiction, and I should be encouraged to read more challenging books. So there was always a kind of, what you're doing isn't good enough.
It's not enough.
You should be doing something else. And actually, when I think back to what they pushed me to read, like when I was, say, 10 and 11, I was encouraged to read things like Jules Verne and Charles Dickens, like really weighty classics. And it completely turned me off them. I have never read them since. Like, and I waded my way through these books.
I know.
And I'm just like, you know, so I think by the time I got to 16 and 18, when I was making these decisions, I just really didn't know what. I firstly didn't really know what really interested me, but I also didn't value what interested me.
Because no one's
taught. I had been kind of trained to, everybody had said, you know, that you don't trust your own drive. Your own instincts. And certainly I would never have chosen psychology, say at sixth form, because I remember psychology being seen as a lesser option, a soft subject. Yep. So I would have even ruled out that opportunity to discover then that it could be interesting. By myself, I would have done that.
Yeah. I do. And just on that note too, about how unimaginative I even think of myself when I was teaching, how unimaginative we are when it comes to jobs and what potential there is out there, you know, like lawyer, doctor, you know.
Yeah. Kids don't know. No.
And then I see the most amazing careers that people are making these days. And I, like, it brings me so much joy to just be like, look at what you can do. Like, there is, blowing my mind that people are making money and making a life and making a joyful life and making a difference in people's lives in careers that I would never have guessed, still get blown away. Someone gets paid to do that. That is so awesome. And so it just makes me so happy when people of our generation found something back then, like, you know, for you to have not have spent too much time before you found that thing that lit you up. So sorry, I've interrupted you, but you were saying about, you went into psychology and you found it, you loved it. You can keep going from there. I'm just loving this so much.
Yeah. So yes, I did my PhD, which was in developmental psychology, especially about autism. Then I did my clinical psychology doctorate, which is, you know, how to use psychology in an applied way with people. Mm. And I'm a clinical psychologist, so I really specialize in mental health and looking after people's mental health. Then I got out into the world of work, and then I had my own children. So my children are now 15 and 12. And as my children grew towards the age that they would have gone to school, as my son, who's the elder one, I felt increasingly uncomfortable with the disconnect between what I had learned about child development in all my degrees and like psychology and what I read and what I saw happening in schools. And I particularly felt uncomfortable with the way, I mean, certainly the removal of agency and autonomy from children and how we think that's acceptable. We think that school is so important that it justifies taking that kind of control over their lives away from children. And also the way that it took learning out of context so that we, you know, I had these small children. I had a lot of time with my small children. I saw how they learned. I saw how everything they learned was in context. They learned things because it was useful to them right now. Like, you know, they learned how to read words like yes and no because that was useful. Or they learned how to read the word free because that was useful.
Yeah.
They didn't learn stuff because it will be useful later. And from a child development perspective, that makes a lot of sense because actually, neurologically, that capacity to do things because it's going to be useful later, it's actually quite late to develop. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they're finding now, the neuroscience studies are finding that there are massive changes in brains from like adolescence, basically from 10, 11 onwards. And one of the things that's coming in at that point is the ability to set goals, the ability to control yourself, the ability to actually say to yourself, okay, I would like to, you know, I would like to be able to play the piano, so I'm going to start practicing the piano. And even though I can't play the piano now, I really want to be able to play the piano, and so I'm going to spend time doing it. So it's that kind of thinking, I'm not just doing the thing that really gives me most joy right now. I've got this kind of delayed goal. But we do that to children in school. We bring them into school and we say, you need to be able to learn to read. At a point when they're not yet interested, right? They're four. I don't know how old they are in Australia. Here they're like four or five. We've got kids who generally aren't that interested in reading yet because they can live a perfectly good 4 or 5 year old life without being able to read. And we say to them, reading is really important. You've got to learn it. And we're going to pull it apart and we're going to make it into the little constituent parts. And we're going to teach you all these little parts and it's all going to add together and then you're going to be able to read. And it's like, that is so cognitively so far away from where these kids are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to make learning more difficult. That's what I started to think. I thought the way that school is organized is going to make learning more difficult. It cannot not make learning more difficult.
And that's what I found so fascinating in your book, because you started out straight away by saying that the school system is not based on learning theory at all. It hasn't been designed to maximize learning. So what principles have they designed the school system on?
I think originally they designed it on the system that we've got quite a lot of kids that we want to keep off the street and we're not allowed to, you know, they can't work anymore because they brought in child labor laws.
Yeah.
And we need to find somewhere for them to be and somewhere for them to be looked after in quite large groups. So I think a lot of it is convenience. A lot of it is we've got these kids, we can't have too many adults taking up. It's expensive to have adults looking after them. So one adult to 30, okay, we can do that. And then it's like, it's kind of, we're doing what we've done for a long time.
Mm.
And I think there's a process that goes on at school where you learn that this is the way learning has to be. Mm. And so you come out of school convinced, even if you did badly at school. In fact, I often find it's the people who did badly at school who are the most convinced that this is the way it has to be. And if I didn't do well in it, it's my fault, not the school's fault. You know, it's because I didn't work hard enough. I was lazy. I didn't put the effort in.
And that is still the conversation we're having, that everyone is blaming everything but the system. It's like, yeah, it's the child's fault. It's the teacher's fault. It's
parents' lazy fault. Lazy parents, not making them school ready.
Exactly. Yeah. And then we have all these like little infights and all of these conversations around those three things. And it never stays, or even not even for long enough, on the actual system itself. And it is so incredibly frustrating because I just think not only is it the problem, it's like it's causing more problems that are being amplified as we go on. Yeah. I think as children and as adults, we're coming through that system, and a lot of us are challenging it, which is why a lot of us opted out. And so we're all grappling with these ideas and still having, like, I know I'm so in, like, because I homeschool my children as well. So 100% in my conviction, like I believe it, but I still have to push past the ideas of certain things. So it was really interesting when you said before, around the age of 10 or 11, do children start to think about that future, like, you know, being able to set goals. And it's just been making me reflect, because my oldest is 11. And one of the things I really struggle with sometimes is the fact that she doesn't want to learn things now. Like she likes the idea of it, but not enough to sit and want to actually achieve a goal. And that's really bothered me. And I've always flow between she's not ready yet, blah, blah, blah. But it helps so much to understand developmentally where they're at. And it also helps to talk to those people who are a few steps ahead of me, which has been one of the best things for me as well, to be like, my child was there too. And now we're starting to see changes.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And also reminding myself that I've learned so much since starting our business. It's been one of the best learning experiences that I have loved every minute of in my 30s, that learning doesn't stop.
No.
Because you've come out of childhood or teenage years, doesn't stop. And there isn't a timeline or a deadline. We're so time bound, like it has to happen now.
I know.
Pressure.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And I was there too. I also had that same, like, looking at my kids when they were pre-pubescent and looking at how, they were exactly like that. They wanted to be able to do things, but they didn't want to go through the process of learning how to do things. They just wanted to be able to do things. They gave up really quickly. They would try something and then they'd be like, nope, not for me. And I would be like, how are they ever going to do this differently? Because I think, like, everybody who's at school believes, I certainly believe, that that's something you learn at school, that you have to be taught at school. And teachers will say that we have to make them do this so that they see the point and so that they learn. And I just think that's, I now think that's completely misguided. I don't think that's how that shift happens. And I've seen it so many kids now, because it is such a massive advantage to actually have teenagers who've seen the process happen. But I've seen that kind of shift. And with both of my kids, I first saw it with bicycle riding, that when they were younger, they both couldn't ride a bicycle and they just weren't, well, they wanted to be able to ride the bike, but they didn't want to be able to learn. They didn't want to learn how to ride the bike because they didn't want to do all the falling off stage and the practicing stage. They just wanted to be able to ride the bike. And then when they were both about 9, 3 years apart, it was like something just switched on. And I remember my son being like, I'm going to learn how to ride that bicycle. And he just put on long sleeves, long trousers, went out every day onto that driveway. We had a driveway outside our house, fell off the bike, fell off the bike, fell off the bike, fell off the bike for like 2 full days. And then he was like, I can ride it now.
Yeah.
And he could. And my daughter had a totally different process. 3 years later, she was like, I'm not going to fall off. You are going to come behind me and hold me up the whole time. Like, okay. She said, you just hold there. You don't let go. We're going to do it. And we did do that. And actually, similarly, in about 2 days, she learned how to ride the bicycle. And it was like, once they'd got that idea and it was there, it wasn't, you know, and I had worried about this. I was like, maybe what happens if they never learn to ride a bicycle? Blah, blah, blah. But once I could see that they were doing that with the bicycle, I was like, okay, I can see it coming and it's going to happen for all sorts of other things.
Do you want to know one of the other stories that you talked about in the book, which really struck with me, was where you talked about immersive learning. And so you talk about your the fact that immersive learning is messy and it's not neat or predictable. Yeah. And you use the example of your daughter learning French. So you must have moved to France for a bit.
Yeah, we went to France for 2 years. So actually, when I wrote that first book, we were actually living in France. They went to a democratic school in France for 2 years, a Sudbury school.
And so so you were saying that she, you know, like you didn't have proper French lessons. She's just immersed.
Never. Totally. And yes.
Yeah.
And it's like pulling in. I think of it like pulling in information when you're immersed in something. It's like you're pulling in bits and you're making them fit together. But it's a completely different system to what it would be like, say, learning French at school, where you go along and they say, you know, today we're doing bonjour. And the funny thing is that she's now 12, and she's just started at another democratic school here, actually, down in Devon, where we are. And the first day or so, the other kids are learning French, and they went in and the first thing was bonjour. And she came back and said, I cannot believe they don't know bonjour. Yeah. But it was like, she hasn't had that experience of having to learn a language in that way at all. Yeah. She said, in fact, no one ever says bonjour. They just say salut.
Yes. Yeah, it was really interesting. I thought, because the way you sort of said it, like if you learn French in a very conventional way, you learn, you know, greetings and certain things. But actually, if you're immersed in it, she might have actually learned the word for Wi-Fi password before actually.
Absolutely. Exactly. You learn what's useful.
You learn what's useful. And then you were saying, like, to see whether someone knows French, they would go through an examination process. And so your daughter may have failed a written test or way they were assessing it, but contextually she would be able to have a conversation with people in France, which is the whole purpose of learning the language in the first place.
Exactly.
And yet that process is not giving you the outcome you think and telling you accurately whether something's being learned. And that was just like mind-blowing as well. Like, you know it, but when you put it in those examples, I was like, that is exactly what we do. We make it sound like we know what needs to be learned and going to assess what we think is being learned, which is completely different.
Yes.
To what
you feel. It is. And with French, with a language, it's so obvious because you can learn a language for 5 years. You can get an exam. I tell the children about this all the time. I have a GCSE in German and I got an A in it when I was 16. I don't think I can even put together one sentence in German now. I just absolutely cannot. But we pretend that this is almost a superior way of learning. Mm-hmm. That, you know, the people said to me things like, well, what about when they properly learn French? It's like, they are properly learning French.
Yeah.
They, you know, what will they do when they're learning it really at school? It's like, that's not how you really learn anything. And I think it's so obvious with a language, but it's the case with everything, really. Like, if I think about myself and psychology, I think the reason that I really got into psychology, and I would still say I'm learning psychology all the time, is because I immersed myself in psychology. I loved it so much that I immersed myself in it. It wasn't because the teachers told me information that was really useful and I've retained that. I don't remember what I learned in my psychology lectures at university. It wasn't about that. It was about this kind of immersion in ideas and making connections. And yeah, that wouldn't necessarily be reflected well in an exam at all. I don't know if the other thing about French, I think, so my son has now actually, so he's the older one, he's actually just done a GCSE in French at 15. And that was a really interesting process for me because it was the first time he'd ever done any kind of formal examination. And he was very like, yeah, I'll go in there, talk French, you know, be fine. But when we went in there to have like the mock exam at the school, they were really focused on how are you going to get your points? You know, you need to say this, you need to say this, you need to say this. And I was like, wow, this isn't about speaking French at all. It's about doing the things that are going to get you the points in this oral exam. And my son just started to look a bit kind of like, what is this about? Mm-hmm. And I would say to him, you know, you do need to say more. Because he said, well, you know, what about if she asked me the question and I answered the question? And I would say, well, because it's an exam, it would be good to then expand on your answer, you know, to show them that you can speak a bit more French than that. And he was like, well, why would I want to do that? I've answered the question. And it's just like, he's thinking about this in a completely different way. Yes. He's just thinking about this as, well, you know, I'm actually speaking French as opposed to I'm trying to get my best.
Yeah. Yes,
exactly.
Isn't it fascinating? Yeah. And so I have a question that I'm curious to know your take on AI and how this is going to change the face of assessment, because I met a guy the other, like 2 weeks ago at a conference, and he said he'd written his 8,000 or maybe it was 16,000 word thesis through AI, and AI was able to accurately write about his personal experience with just a few prompts, and he did his whole thesis on it.
Wow. But he did his thesis on that, presumably, rather than simply generating his thesis and handing it in.
Yeah, so I think he used it obviously to prompt certain things, and he must have input enough of his personal information, but it was meant to be a personalized, like his experience working in hospitality. Or I remember him saying, we're like, yeah. How did you do that though? Like, how do they not know it's AI? He goes, that it was so accurate in my experience. Like, it was able to generate my own experience so accurately. And we were just like, it was just, I mean, we've been having this conversation amongst a lot of my homeschooling friends who are also teachers.
Yeah.
Thinking about how AI, it emerged so quickly.
Yeah.
How is it in education?
Really interesting, isn't it? And I think we don't know, but I think one thing that interests me about AI and about how it's getting talked about in schools is a lot of it is about, well, kids are going to use this to cheat. Kids are going to use this to game the system, basically. And for me, as someone, as a self-directed learning enthusiast, I guess my question would be, if you're doing the learning for yourself and because you're interested in it, why would you want to game the system? Like, I'm writing my book, right? Maybe if I spent a bit of time thinking about it, I would be able to get AI to write this book for me. But why would I do that? Do you see what I mean? Because you only do that if you set up this system of, we are going to assess you on these quite rigid criteria, and your job really is to, like in the French exam, to get as many points as you can. Mm-hmm. It's not actually about the learning. And I think I talk about this in my first book as well, that the shift from you're learning for your own sake because you really want to know and you're really interested, at which point AI might be useful because you could ask it some questions, but it's not going to replace that.
That's right.
And when you're at the point of, I'm learning because somebody else is going to judge me for it and they're going to give me a score for it. And that is really only reason why I'm doing it. In which case, it makes perfect sense to use AI if you could.
Yes.
But it's gaming the system.
And so the system has to change, right?
Yes, it does.
That they have to decide, well, you know, I guess it's making us really consider whether the assessments we have been asking children to do, whether they could cheat on AI or not.
Yeah. Do they have any point?
Yeah.
Because if AI can do it, why are we training kids to do it, right?
That's right. Why?
What's the point of training kids to do it?
Yeah. So it's going to make us be very, very clear about what outcomes and what learning actually looks like.
Yeah. Because I think it could be good. No, I think it really does challenge us, and it challenges us to think about why kids are doing things. And if we are setting up a system where cheating is an obvious thing to do, then people are going to try and cheat. Mm. You know, if we're setting up a system, I mean, we see this just across the board, don't we? Like, there's scandals all the time about people cheating to get into things, people cheating to sell stuff. People just, if you set up a system which rewards, which kind of puts outcome over process, that's how I would put it.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think it's such a mistake in education to put outcome over process. I think, you know, I can see how in the workplace that might well be something you need to do, but in education, I just don't see a reason why we should make everything so outcome focused. Because when we do that, we shift the focus for the kids, for the teachers, for the parents, for everyone from what am I doing to I've got to show what I'm doing and be judged on it.
That's right. So it's like, what the skills we need to do school well, as opposed to the skills I need to learn what I need to learn.
Yeah. And to discover my passions and what really interests me. And process is messy. It's like immersive learning. You can't track it nicely. It doesn't look linear. You know, you can't say all 8-year-olds should be doing this. You have to. But I think the weird thing is that I think that lots of people know this. And I think the people who know this most are actually early years educators.
Yes.
Because we do have a place in our education system where self-direction, autonomy is valued. We do have a place where the adult job is to be available, to curate the environment, to provide opportunities for young people. And the young people are the ones who choose how they do it, and they can stop when they want to. And, you know, no one is generally going to say, right, you've got to have 2 hours of water play today, 2 hours of sand box tomorrow. Mm-hmm. You know, you are allowed to come and go from things as you want.
And actually those early years teachers are having to tune more into that psychology. Like, they're actually there to help with the emotional process and the emotional learning, as opposed to the academic learning. And there's that, you know, and they're battling.
And it's not valued.
Yeah, they have to battle to remind the powers that be, that that's actually their job, that the academic side of things is not their job as early educators. It's actually to help them with their emotional, you know, intelligence and learning how to be a human.
Yeah, and it's there for learning how to be creative, how to solve problems, all of that stuff happens much more in a self-directed learning environment like a good nursery school than it does when you sit children in rows and control them and tell them you've got to do these things. And I think, you know, I think it's tragedy that what's happening in our education system, at least in the UK, is the principles of secondary are being extended down into primary and the principles of primary are being extended down into early years. So I would like it to be going the other way. Mm-hmm. You know, if early years was informing the whole of primary,
yes,
rather than it being actually in early years, you really should be getting on with letting them to learn that read and write their names and get, you know, it's just like, why do we don't, there's no evidence that it's better to do it earlier.
That's right. There is, and that's the thing, there isn't the evidence, and yet we're still battling with people who are coming up with all of the rules for the game without any evidence to support it. And I think that that is a really frustrating place to be from people who are so desperate to see things change. And what happens is I think a lot of people end up, you know, all these good people who can see what the right thing to do is end up going, you know what, I'm just going to do my own thing with my own family now.
Yeah.
Because you're not listening.
Because it's so frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So frustrating.
Loads of teachers. Exactly. Loads of teachers. You've seen it from the inside. Yeah.
Oh, 100%. You're talking a lot about autonomy, which is something is so important. But one of the things, and this is a bit of a theme that's been coming up for me a lot lately, is but helping children to say no. Like this is something that we actively need to help children to do. And I think on it's probably a separate topic, but also learning to hear no as well. For me, like when it comes to like hearing no from other people and being gracious and hearing that no, but also being able to say no in themselves as well to honor their own feelings.
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting thing. I write quite a lot about this actually, about how we tend not to value children's no's, or we value their yeses. Yeah. And so we always value participation over non-participation, for example, or going somewhere over not going somewhere, or staying somewhere for a long time, as opposed to saying after an hour, actually, no, I've had enough, don't want to do this anymore. And I think we have to actively kind of make those no's visible. I talk about it sometimes as it's like giving permission to children to say the no. So just saying things. So sometimes I talk about it like scales. It's like when parents say things to their kids, often there's a kind of implicit hidden loading of, I really want you to say yes. You know, like, would you like to come and read a story with me? Is that a real balanced question? Or is it, come and read a story with me? If the child says something like, no, I'd rather play Minecraft, that's definitely the disappointing answer there for the parent. So I think the parent has to literally try and balance those things up and say, you know, we could read a story, but we don't have to. Other things could be good as well. So that you're kind of showing them, you know, like, or we could go out to the park, but also we could stay here and curl up on the sofa. That would be good too. So you're kind of showing them that you're not, that it's okay for them to own that. And I think, you know, I definitely see myself as someone who found it very difficult to say no, and I still find it difficult to say no. And one of the things that I see in my children, having not ever had the experience of being put in a setting where they couldn't leave and where they had to stay, they're really good at leaving. They're really good at saying, no waste of my time, off I go. And I'm kind of like, oh, you know, shouldn't you have stayed there for a bit longer? No, they say, I think I've learned enough. And I think it's so hard as a parent. You hear that and you sort of go, gulp. Is that really okay? We've gone all this way for this group and now you're saying, nah, don't think it's for me. And are they giving up too early? All of that kind of stuff. But I also, I think one thing that can help with parents is that firstly, you kind of value your kids' no's as much as their yeses, but as well, you don't take their no's as completely closing a door. Because I think there can also be a thing that a child might say no to something one time for so many reasons, right? One of it might be their own kind of internal autonomy, but another might be really high anxiety, unfamiliarity with new places. All sorts of reasons might mean a child say no. And I think it's important that that doesn't close down opportunities each time. So I do meet parents who are like, oh, you know, we went to the soft play, they said no, so we don't go anymore. Went to the playground, they said no, we don't do that anymore. And it's like your world is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And actually the job as a parent needs to be to making it bigger and bigger and bigger as they grow. And so I think there kind of needs to be a feeling, well, yeah, no, we say no today, but maybe we'll do it tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I think the other way to do that is to make your own feelings visible, your own internal feelings visible. Mm-hmm. So to talk about your internal process, you know, like,
yeah,
well, I was thinking about doing this, but then I thought, actually, no, I'm not going to do it today, but maybe I'll do it tomorrow. Do you know what I mean? So you kind of narrate that for them so they can see it.
Yes. I think I've also had to learn to be honest about why, like, you know, when I have tried to push in times where they've done that, where they've said no, mm-hmm. and I'm like, oh,
yeah,
and have to be really honest and be like, you know what, sometimes I feel the social pressure. Like, I feel like, this is my thing. This is what I'm carrying. And this is why I may have said things that made you feel like you had to make a different choice, or made you, you know, probably shamed you a little bit into, this is what it was feeling. That's what I was feeling like at the time.
Yes, I think that's really helpful, because otherwise you can't be neutral, because children pick up on it.
That's
they
right.
They know. And you could pretend that you don't feel the social pressure. But I think also just always making these things visible is good.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can say, you know, I feel like everybody's looking at me about this one, but that's okay. I can sit with that.
That's
you know,
right. Yeah.
And kind of own it. And say you can still make that decision. You can still say no, even though for me, my temptation is to try and push you into saying yes.
Absolutely. I'd like to jump a little bit to homeschooling parents and people mm-hmm. that are starting their homeschooling journey. What do you think are some of the main assumptions that we take from our own schooling experience and our own idea of what education looks like when we first try and
do something different?
Take the road less traveled. What are some of the main assumptions that parents might have that can make things
so different? I think many parents have the assumption that they will do something quite school-like at home and that that's what successful homeschooling or home education, we call it here, looks like, that, you know, you need to have a certain number of hours a day. And I think most parents, I think all parents maybe carry the assumption that if you don't make children do things, there are things they'll never learn. And therefore, I meet parents who say things like, well, you know, we just have to cover maths and English because that's really important. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to make them do that. And I have the kind of opposite perspective, because basically, if I think something's really important, then I absolutely don't want to force them to do that, because I feel like wherever I make them do it, I damage the learning, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I want to provide opportunities without the pressure, because the pressure kills the love of learning. But I think, I think many parents, and I think also parents often have a kind of time scale in their heads of when you should do things, because that's what happens in the school system. So I certainly had that when I began. Like, you know, they learn to read in the UK at age 5 or 6 in the school system.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know, okay, what if they haven't learned to read when they're 5 or 6? And they didn't. Mm-hmm. My kids didn't learn to read when they were 5 or 6. What, you know, help? Does that mean we're really behind? Does that mean I'm being really neglectful? How? And I think that kind of tracking of the school system is quite hard to get away from.
Yeah.
Certainly, I had to really consciously step away from tracking what kids might have been doing in the school system, because they are in one system of education and they are being taught a curriculum. And it's easy to see that and think, oh, my kids aren't doing anything like that. Look, they're still like playing on the trees all day. And these kids are like writing essays.
Yeah.
How did that happen?
Yeah.
You know, this little gap. And I think that when I started out, I did think that we would have a kind of extended play-based stage, like, you know, some education systems say, like Montessori or Steiner have a longer play-based stage where they might do play up to 7 or 8. And then I thought, you know, at that point, maybe my children will be more ready for more formal learning or become more like kids in the school system. And what I didn't anticipate was that the longer we were out of it, the more different they got than the kids in the school system.
Yeah.
So like at 7 and 8, it was like, there's absolutely no way that we would be going into the school system now. It would just not work on any level. And of course, they hadn't gone through that training. And I think that you have to be ready for that. I think child development looks really different. That's another thing I talk about in my book, that when I learned about child development, and I've read loads of studies on child development, they never say this is child development in the context of school because school is invisible.
Mm-hmm.
It's just accepted. Like when I did my PhD, I saw hundreds of children. I recruited them through schools. So, of course, I saw just school children.
Yes.
Didn't occur to me I was missing any kids because where are kids? They're at school, right?
They're all at school.
They're all at school. So And when I saw how differently things could be when my kids didn't go to school, it made me think, wow, there's this huge invisible intervention that's going on into children's childhoods, 30 hours a week minimum every week for like 12 or 13 years, mm-hmm. which we don't see as an intervention. We just see it as natural. That's what children do. But actually, you know, when that doesn't happen, how do children develop? And it, yeah. I think it's different.
I find that that's actually one of the things I find so fascinating. That's why I've been drawn to Peter Gray's work and your work is that, you know, thinking outside of what has happened in the last 200 years in terms of the way that we've done things and looking at, you know, people who, how we've lived in the past, evolutionary wise.
Yeah.
And how happy, like, and also just looking at how miserable the Western world seems to be.
Yeah, really miserable, and telling everybody else they should do it like us.
Exactly. And so I just get so curious. And I think I really resonate with Carol Black, uses that analogy about looking at orcas in SeaWorld and saying that's what orcas' behavior is like.
Totally resonate with that. Absolutely.
And then it's completely different to orcas in the wild. Like and cheese, and not, it's almost like they're a different species when you compare, when you actually look at how they live, they're totally different. Yeah. And that resonated so strongly with me thinking about children in schools.
Yes, absolutely. And I think if you homeschool, there are like little surprises all the way along. I still have this, like, things that I realize my children aren't learning from the school system and how different that is. I mean, when they were really young, it was just things like the fact you go to school Monday to Friday and not on Saturday and Sundays. They didn't learn that because, you know, it was, but also just things like, we had this conversation when my son was about 8 or 9 about clever and what clever meant. Mm-hmm. We were with a group of schooled kids and they were saying, you know, oh yes, they're really clever, or they're really clever, but, you know, they're dyslexic, so they struggle with reading. And I was like, wow, this way of kind of classifying people is so pervasive in the school system and so completely not there in my children's world, because they're not compared with their peers all the time on how they perform on academic tasks. They have no idea how their friends might do in a maths test.
They don't even say, I mean, kids do care about age, but they don't care about age at the same time. Like, they care about, you know, I'm older, you're younger, but then that so falls away and they're not comparing. They're only comparing like the actual number age, but not where they are and what they can do. Like, a 5-year-old will oftentimes, you know, see themselves as such an equal to a 10-year-old or a 15-year-old in so many ways.
Yes, that's true.
Nikki, my business partner, did a post about, we had our homeschool photos done at one of our co-ops, and she said, like, it gave her goosebumps having a look at the photos of all of the children just wearing and being, who, you know, bright
hair everywhere. And,
not brushed hair.
I know, it's
hair,
so cool.
Bright hair, wearing whatever, like clothing that I couldn't even imagine being comfortable wearing if I was at school. And none of the children have any idea that us as parents are sitting there like having a moment over their school photo. They're just like, oh, yeah, whatever. Like, I don't even understand photos. And we're all just like, oh, my gosh, like, I can't believe this freedom that you get to experience in your life. You have no idea of the stuff that you're, like, you know, we often worry about what they won't, what they're missing out on, what they need to learn. But also, like, as you say, what are they? What is the benefit of not learning some of the things that children at school will learn that is
absolutely
not?
Yeah, I think about that a lot when you look at a group of home ed kids, how different they all are and how much more different they are than if you look at a group of schooled kids where they're all sitting in, they're all being made to look the same. They dress the same, sit the same, do the same thing. And, you know, you have your group of home ed kids, and even if there's class going on, you're always going to have someone who's under the table. You're always going to have someone who's hanging upside down from a chair or on a tree. You're always going to have someone saying, nah, it's not for me. Yep. You know, you've got like diversity right there in every group. And I think it's just amazing. And I think one of the things that got me thinking really early on, actually, as well, was seeing how lots of behaviors that my children and other children I knew had when they were young children, and when they were young children, it was accepted that they would have it. Like, you know, just things like jumping up and down when they got excited. You know, they got excited, jump up, down, hooray, 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 move your hands around, whatever, show it with your whole body. Then I could see kids going into school and quite quickly they weren't doing that anymore. Mm. And they were starting to sort of, and I remember we met up with one other child who we'd known before school, and then she'd gone to school. And my son was jumping up and down with excitement, waving his hands around and making noises. And she said, "Why is he doing that?" And I was like, "He's excited. That's what he does when he's excited." And, you know, a couple of years ago, they would have both been doing that when they were excited.
Yeah.
But she had now been put into this environment where that wasn't acceptable. And she was learning that it wasn't acceptable. Mm. And the fact that these other kids, these home educated kids, weren't learning that, I think was something quite special, actually, about them being able to express themselves and to continue to express themselves.
So then, Naomi, what do you think we could be doing right now? What can parents do right now, or teachers be doing right now to make changes? Do you have suggestions?
So there are some teachers trying to bring in more autonomy at some points. And I think you can do that if that's, well, it depends on your school. I think you really do need to be supported in some ways by the school. But there are inspiring stories of some teachers who have prioritized different things in their classroom rather than it being all about the exam results and the curriculum. And it can just be really basic things like giving children free choice about what they write about, or, you know, just adding little bits of autonomy, or taking out grading of some things. Mm. So saying, you know, we're going to do this. And there's research that shows that when you say to kids, you know, we're going to do this and I'm going to grade you at the end of it, versus we're going to do this and we're just doing it because it's interesting. You can choose it because it's interesting. They do it differently. And the one that's just interesting, they generally do to a higher quality, which is kind of the reverse of what we think, right? We think, oh, they don't take it seriously unless they're graded. Mm. But I think we train children into that. We teach them that it's only serious if it's graded. And then we turn around and say, oh, they only take things seriously if they're graded. It's the kind of thing where, you know, children say, is it going to be on the test?
Yes.
We train them into that.
Yes. Yeah.
We teach them that it's only really important if it's on the test. And then we blame them when they say, I'm not going to do it unless it's on the test. Well, you set that up, really.
Mm.
So I think as teachers, there's a kind of, can I bring in things where assessment is not the aim? And I think it's easier, actually, the younger they are, because the closer they are to being play oriented with play, it's hard with 13 and 14 year olds. I do think it's really hard when they've had 10 years in the system. For parents, I think you can do stuff after school where you step away from this model. You know, often kids will be spending all of their time doing structured activities which are outcome focused. So even if they do extracurricular stuff, it'll be music lessons where they'll be working towards an exam, or they'll be doing art lessons where it's about producing the art for the exhibition. Even things like drama classes. My daughter did some drama classes and I just thought it would be fun for her, but it was all about the end of term show, actually. Yeah. And it was all about practicing for this end of term show. Everything becomes about outcome. And I just think we really need to get our kids to be doing stuff where it's about process for as long as possible, and giving them opportunities to do stuff where it's about process and where we're saying it doesn't matter. And not just saying that, because often parents, of course, say it doesn't matter how you do in your exam. But let's just not do the exams.
Yeah.
Let's just, you know, if you want to play an instrument, let's just play that instrument.
Yeah, I guess in examining too, like, we say it doesn't matter, but how else are we saying that it matters? Like,
yeah, exactly.
The fact that it may not have come out of our mouths, but is there other ways in which we have been reinforcing that idea?
Of course there is. Yeah. I mean, just the exams, just the whole way they're done says this matters, don't they? Mm-hmm. Like, you go to a special room, you have to sit in a special place, you have to perform in a special way. There's a special person who's the examiner. Everything is set up so this is important. This really matters.
Mm.
I think it gives children a really mixed message if you put them through that while saying, we don't mind what you get. Well, why are you doing it then?
Yeah.
Doesn't, you know, why not just say, oh, we don't have to do that. Let's just play. And if they want to do it, then that's okay. But then I would, as a parent, not be very focused on how they do it, making them practice for it. I sometimes meet parents say, well, they really want to do that exam, so, you know, now I have to make them practice. You don't, you know, they can just do that exam. What's the worst that can happen? They fail an exam. Actually, failing an exam is quite a useful learning process to go through.
Yeah.
and why not do it when you're younger? People sometimes say to me when I'm talking about autonomy and choices, they say, I can't let my children make choices because they make such bad choices. And I often say, well, you know, what better time to practice making bad choices than when you're nine?
When there's nothing at stake.
it's very unlikely you're going to lose your home, for example, yeah. at nine because yeah. of your choices. Whereas if you don't get to make any decisions until you're 23, which does happen to quite a lot of people, then actually the consequences are much, much higher.
Yeah.
And people, we're sort of spitting people out of the system who just don't have much practice of making decisions, thinking mm-hmm. things through for themselves. Absolutely. And I think then the consequences for some of them are bad.
Ugh. This has been such a great conversation, Naomi. Thank you so much for giving so much of your time tonight. I am aware that we've been chatting for a while. Where can people find out more about your work? Or you have so many great takes on things. Where can people read and, you know, follow along with your ideas?
So my kind of one-stop shop is my website, naomifisher.co.uk. It has links to my other social media stuff. Mm-hmm. But I have two books. Changing Our Minds is the one that we've been talking about yep. mostly today. And then I have another one, which is A Different Way to Learn, which is specifically about neurodiversity and self-directed education. And then I also have a Substack, which is like a newsletter that gets delivered to your inbox every Monday. So that's good for people who don't like social media
yes.
because it's just an email and it's free. And that's called Think Again, Naomi C. Fisher, Substack.com. And then Facebook, Dr. Naomi Fisher is my Brilliant. Other place.
I'll make sure we link all of those things in our show notes. So for anyone that wants Brilliant. To just have somewhere to click and find everything, they'll be able to, because I think that... Oh, we covered so many topics tonight. Today it was tonight, actually.
this morning for me.
this morning for you, tonight for me. Yeah. And I think that they're so valuable, and I love having these conversations with more people and hopefully, you know, just inspiring people to think a bit differently about the way that we've always done things so that we can have a bit more of a brighter future for the next gen.
It's been really great to talk to you. Thank you for inviting me.
You're so welcome. Well, there you have it. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation. And I also just want to note before I go that even if you're not on the same journey as both Naomi and I in terms of self-directed education or homeschooling, I just hope that the points that we discussed today really resonated and sparked maybe some questions or some curiosity around the way that we do things within our education system. And it's important to actually see what's happening and to hear what's happening within the system, because we need to be catering for all children and start to really see and highlight some of the problems that it has created, because we need to have more child advocates making noise for change. Now, as always, I love doing this journey with you. So until next time, stay wild.